Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. We are joined today by the religious historian and best-selling author Karen Armstrong, who has been described as arguably the most lucid, wide-ranging and consistently interesting religion writer today, according to Wikipedia. She is perhaps best known for her books on comparative religion, including A History of God, A Short History of Myth and The Spiral Staircase. Her work focuses on commonalities of the major religions, such as the importance of compassion and the Golden Rule, and her latest book, Fields of Blood, challenges the notion that wars are generally caused by religion. She received the TED Prize in 2008, which was the impetus for the creation of the Charter for Compassion, a document which urges the peoples and religions of the world to embrace the core values of compassion. She's going to talk to us today about what religion is, why it matters, and in what way it might relate to the Middle Way. Okay. Hello, Karen. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Thank you.
Okay, well, let's dive in, basically. You say that it's only since the modern period that we've been using the term religion. Why did that happen, and how was it perceived before that?
Well, if you look at the way we translate words in other languages as religion, you look at these words in the original, and they invariably refer to a whole way of life. Deen in Arabic refers to all life, a whole lifestyle, yeah, not just the religious aspects, yeah, of it. And similarly, Dharma in Sanskrit applies to social, economic, legal, as well as what we would call religious matters. Before the modern period, religion permeated all aspects of life. It wasn't something separate. It just transfused the whole of life, rather like a gin in a cocktail. And to try and take religion out of politics, for example, would have been as difficult as trying to take the gin out of the cocktail, because we're meaning-seeking creatures. Yeah. We want meaning. We want to endow everything we do with some kind of significance. We fall very easily into despair, unlike dogs and cats, if we can't find some significance and purpose in what we're doing. Things changed, however, in the West, in the modern period.
Are you talking from Enlightenment onwards?
Or? I'm talking about the 17th, 18th centuries. Yeah. You have philosophers like John Locke in Britain, statesmen like the founding fathers of the United States, who said we must keep politics and religion separate. This was in part inspired by the so-called wars of religion of the 16th and 17th century, a terrible wars which left a third of the population of Europe dead. Mm-hmm. And it was generally thought that Christians in Western Europe had been so inflamed by the theological quarrels of the Reformation that they then slaughtered one another in these senseless wars, hence the wars of religion. In fact, though, religion and politics were inextricably combined in that cocktail. And if it had been all about religion, you wouldn't have expected to find Catholics and Protestants fighting on the same side. But in fact, they often did so, and therefore killed and fought their co-religionists. The wars of religion were also about a political battle. The emperor, Charles V, wanted to create a European-wide empire on the model of the Ottoman Empire.
Right.
The princes and the monarchs of Europe wanted to preserve their own liberties and form independent sovereign states. Strong, independent, and they're the ones who won. But that was a long struggle for over 1,000 years. So when you separate religion and politics, what you're doing in philosophical terms, what you're actually doing is giving a philosophical reason for what is actually politically happening within these states. In order to gain sovereign control, that is complete control over their state in a way that hadn't really been possible before, because modern communications and things were developing.
Sure.
Therefore, the churches, which were imbued with the whole aristocratic system and government, had to be subdued. And therefore, you have a sort of separation of church and state. It is the idea that religion and politics and that religion must be is so explosive and inflammable that it must be kept separate from ordinary concerns, political concerns. This is deeply enshrined in our secularised conscience, but no other culture has anything like it.
Interesting. Okay. You argue that it's more helpful in many ways to talk about trust rather than belief when talking about religion. Could you expand on that?
Not even trust, really. Okay. A belief is a modern... the word belief, as we use it today, is again a modern construct of the Enlightenment.
Okay.
It was used first by the philosophers and scientists, people such as Newton, to indicate an intellectual acceptance of a set of rather dubious propositions. Newton said that he hoped that the solar system that he was discovering would work, as he said, for considering people with belief in a deity. Now, the word belief in Middle English, pre-modern English, didn't mean that intellectual acceptance of a set of propositions. It meant commitment,
okay.
Trust. As we still use it that way when we say we have faith in a person or a system.
Yeah.
And it translated in the New Testament the Greek word pistis, where Jesus is asking for belief or faith. But he's not asking people to believe that he was the Son of God or
right.
the second person of the Trinity or anything theological. He was asking for commitment, if you read the Gospels, for people who would devote themselves,
yeah.
life and soul, to the coming of the kingdom, in which rich and poor would sit at the same table, where you were expected to give all you had to the poor, and just devote your whole life to this. That was what faith was.
Right.
And you have it in Chaucer, who says to his knight says to his liege lady, "Accept my beliefer, accept
yeah.
my loyalty, my commitment to your cause." We've made it belief a set of intellectual acceptance of a set of rather weird creedal components, but that's not what that's a modern thing.
Concept.
And we've made religion into a kind of head trip.
Interesting.
And unless the point about in the pre-modern world was that the myths of religion were inseparable from doing it. A myth makes no sense unless you put it into practice. And these dogmas and beliefs that we have began as calls to action rather than as calls to an intellectual acceptance.
Yes.
And if you don't do the action, you don't get the meaning of the doctrine.
Sure. Okay. Could we just have a look at this relationship between logos and mythos and perhaps how that relates to belief and meaning?
Well, logos, it generally refers to reason, logic, the word logical comes from that.
Yeah.
And that is that side of our analytic side of our mind is very essential to our modern society, to our modern economy, and to modern scientific developments, technology, all the rest of it. And it's forged ahead wonderfully.
Yeah.
But we also, as human beings, we also need mythos. Now, in popular parlance, myth often means something that isn't true. If a politician is accused of a peccadillo in his or her past life, he'll say, oh, it's a myth, it didn't happen. Whereas, in fact, in the pre-modern world, a myth was something that in some sense happened once, but which also happens all the time. It refers to an underlie at those aspects of life that are continually present with us. Our struggle between life and death, our struggle to sort of live with despair and sorrow,
yeah.
All these things that we struggle with daily as human beings, we've developed ways of thinking and speaking about them that can't be controlled by logic and reason. When we're confronted with death or our own death, approaching death, it's very difficult. Logic won't help us here. And we've developed mythical stories very often which tell those stories, which help to bring those truths alive. But important, as I said earlier, a myth makes no sense unless you put it into action.
Okay, so to transpose that to God, say, so people can have a meaningful experience of God without having to believe in him.
It's impossible to define what you mean by God. If you can define what you mean by God, that's not God. That's an idol. That's a projection of a human projection onto transcendence. We have a transcendence element in our lives. We all know part of human nature is our hope, our grasp of the world is that something always eludes us.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the 20th century, it was assumed that there were just one or two little points to be cleared up in the Newtonian system, and then we'd know about the universe. And then 20 years later, Einstein comes along, and you have a universe that is absolutely unthinkable, undescribable, and incomprehensible in its largest reach.
Yeah.
And so that transcendence, God is what is transcendent. It is not he or she or even it. It is all that is, as they say, it's being itself. And the great theologians in all three of the God religions, Judaism, Christianity and Islam, say that it's not acceptable really to say that God exists, because our notion of existence is too limited. God is, as Aquinas said, being itself.
Yeah. Your stance seems to be very resonant also with the mystical traditions in the major religions. To what degree have you been influenced by them? Like, for example, Meister Eckhart or the Sufis in Islam, or the Quakers.
I'm not a mystic myself, but I have great sympathy, because they are the people who keep pushing us towards that transcendence. God cannot be contained in simple propositions, nor can you say what God wants or what God desires or what God has done. These are potentially dangerous things. You're just projecting what you think God should do, and this is what we call idolatry.
Okay, no, that's great. What do you think puts people off the idea of religion?
Well, just looking at some of these clerics on the television is enough to put anybody off, I think. I mean, really, at the moment, we're just after the Brexit campaign, we're experiencing a surge in horrible racist attacks throughout the country. Where are the clerics?
Mm.
Where are the religious people coming to say stop this? And you know, they're fine about condemning homosexuality or condemning certain beliefs or practices or political opinions, but where are they when it comes to human suffering and the divisions that are tearing our world apart? There are one or two, my friend Desmond Tutu, for example. I think it's just these people sitting in their churches saying their prayers very nicely and letting the world go to hell in a handbasket, really. It's what it seems. I mean, Jesus was finally gets himself crucified.
Yeah.
The prophets of Israel all suffer danger, and similarly the prophet Muhammad. Buddha spends his whole life after his enlightenment, 40 years tramping around the towns and villages of India to try to help people deal with their pain. And I think that unless religious people are seen to be doing this, then no, they're not going to win any respect.
Sure, but if you think of people like Jesus or the Buddha, to actually manage that level of commitment, for example, to give up all your possessions or whatever, for most people is not sort of a practical thing.
Never mind about that. But you can make a difference in your own immediate circle, and you can get hold of your MP and make them do something, or you can start a movement.
Yeah.
You can do something.
Exactly.
Instead of just sitting around complacently saying your own prayers.
Yep. Oh, no, I agree absolutely, Karen. Okay. So just on that point, especially in relation to young people, because we've just been talking about Brexit, young people are feeling very sort of frustrated. How can religion engage with young people? How can they get them to engage?
I don't know. At the moment, I think it's very, in Britain, it's very difficult. In the United States, it's quite easy. I go there a lot, and people are engaged with religion. Here, people are not, and for all kinds of reasons, as I've demonstrated.
Mm-hmm.
I think that young people will only be activated. I don't care whether people go to church or not, or say their prayers, or believe in some chimera they call God or Jesus or whatever. As long as they live the life, as long as they see people living the life, putting others first, being concerned, socially concerned and distressed by the pain that we're seeing in the world.
Yeah.
I think young people there are conflicting things. They're encouraged to be at the moment to sort of get on and make money and to be successful. They're not encouraged always, and their elders, so-called betters, are not giving them an example in caring for other people and other peoples around the world.
Sure.
As there's a sort of terrible myopia, and we've become shallow in the way we think.
I think so, yeah.
In damning the bad religious practice, we've confined ourselves very much to surface things, or cheap bits of psychology, or cheap little spiritualities where people just think, sit around chanting, etc., without feeling that impetus to go out and
engage
with the pain in the world.
Yeah.
I think we should be, when we look at these migrants, see these pictures of migrants, for example, people dying in Turkey, for example. We should allow this to disturb us. And let those, because a compassionate person is an uncomfortable person, uncomfortable that there's pain anywhere in the world. And we're so myopic about all this talk about, in the Brexit campaign, about getting our country back, etc., and virtually letting the rest of the world go hang, keeping them out.
Yeah.
This is doomed to a very terrible end, I think.
No, I agree. Yeah. Well, maybe one hope is again something that you've been initiator of, the Charter for Compassion. How might one get involved in that?
Well, you see, quite a bit of it has been quite disappointing to me, because people have... I wrote a book called 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life, and there are 12 steps, very often people have stopped at 3. having compassion for yourself. Now, it's important to have that compassion for yourself,
sure.
But there are another steps that go on that take you out to embrace the whole world.
Yeah.
Because the great sages said, you cannot confine your compassion to your own group. You must have concern for everybody.
Yeah.
Love the stranger, says Leviticus. If a stranger lives with you in your land, do not molest him. You must treat him as one of your own people and love him as yourself, for you were foreigners in Egypt.
Yeah.
That's a message for our time. So instead, people have been having sort of little appreciation days where they sit around telling each other how much they appreciate each other. This is nonsense. This is all ego. The best things that are happening, interestingly, are in Pakistan, a country right on the edge of so many of the conflicts that are tearing our world apart, where a businessman has started a network of schools of compassion. There are over 1,000 of them now, where compassion is integrated into core subjects of the curriculum to train the leaders of tomorrow.
Fantastic.
And Karachi, we're developing a system of cities of compassion, whereby the mayor engages with businesses and schools and universities in the city to adopt the charter and try to practically, it can't just be a love-in day, to implement the Golden Rule in the urban conditions of the 21st century. And Karachi is our best city. And it's the young people from the schools who made the plea to the mayor.
Fantastic.
To be this. They wanted a city where people, where there was, because there's terrible inequality in Pakistan, to sort of where everybody child has a chance, where they can go out, or their parents can go out without being blown up by a suicide bomber. As a city, they're concentrating on three things: compassion in education, compassion in business, and compassion in driving. A small thing that you can do every day that is important, that you can even save lives. We're just in a transitional stage. One of our best cities is Louisville in Kentucky, right on the Bible Belt, where the mayor, a multimillionaire, campaigned for compassion, on compassion, because he said it makes perfect sense to him, not religiously, but as in communities and in business. And he bought a Holiday Inn. They've concentrated on homelessness in the city. He bought a Holiday Inn and put it at the disposal of the homeless. So nobody in Louisville needs, unless they wish to sleep outside. He's also set up a mentoring process whereby the disaffected kids, black kids mostly, because they have a problem with the African-American people in the southern United States, are mentored by older kids who see them two or three times a week, find out what's going on, they take them to a game or take them, do something with them, and they have a system of informing the schools when something has gone wrong in the child's home, so that the schools are poised and ready to go forward. And it's had an effect on the community, and friends tell me in Louisville, I was just there last month, that the mayor himself has changed as a result of doing this.
Because
it affects you. For example, just last year, a mosque was vandalised, and the mayor went on television and said this was unacceptable, and could some volunteers come on a certain day, a certain hour to clean it up. 1,000 people showed up from all over the city, all ages, all classes, all colours, and cleaned the whole thing up in a morning.
Wonderful.
And that wouldn't have happened a few years ago. So there are other cities, none of them in the UK, but in the United States, in Pakistan, Amman in Jordan is very keen. Again, right on the edge between Israel on one side and Iraq on the other, with refugees like you couldn't imagine. Where we keep making our fuss about accepting a few people, they're a poor country, no resources, swamped with refugees, most of whom have been integrated in society and are not in camps. So when the mayor went up, called me to see him when I was in Amman last year, and he says, we're already doing this. And in fact, he said, we are all refugees. He himself came from Palestine. We know what it's like. So that is my best hope for the charter, because it's so practical.
It sounds quite inspiring what you've just said there, really. So
interestingly, it's not been the religious people who came forward to help me. In fact, some religious people have been quite who are actually involved in the charter, but have been quite inimical to it. For their own ego is clearly involved.
In play,
But it's been business people. Again, like the young businessman in Pakistan who sees the potential.
Potential for it,
And they're good because businessmen know about piloting a project. So you don't raise expectations too high. You learn to see what's working, what isn't, and you can translate an abstract idea into something practical and viable.
Smashing. Oh, well, you know, I just wish you all the luck with that. Well, no, it's not luck,
it's hard work.
Hard work, exactly, yes.
But we're just, the city's coming, we're taking it out of the rest of the charter because it's our main thing, I think. And Louisville, the team there are going to run the city's campaign.
Okay. Okay, well, my last question, Karen. What is your understanding of the middle way and how might that relate to what we've been talking about today, if at all?
I don't know anything about the middle way.
Well, I suppose it stems originally from Buddhism. It's the idea that if you avoid fixed beliefs about things, then you can arguably make better decisions.
Yes, you just keep your mind open and realise how little you know. We are a very omniscient society and everybody's encouraged to have their own opinions, and these opinions get hardened, and yet we know very little, tiny little bits. We can't. Our minds aren't getting to the stage because of computers and Twitter, etc., that we can only take in sound bites now, and not the complexity of world affairs. And that's been evident in the Brexit whole issue. And yet people have been so angry and righteousness on all sides, and this is hopeless. The thing to realise is how little you know. However learned you are, there's always more that you don't know.
Yeah, and I think if you have that started, a lot of people think that if you recognise uncertainty, that's somehow a recipe for nihilism or relativism. But if you hold your beliefs more lightly and recognise that they could be wrong, then arguably you're more open to alternatives. And
it's also the truth.
Yeah.
Because none of us can really understand ourselves, let alone other people, let alone whole cultures. I mean, I'm continually struggling with people's entrenched views about Islam, for example.
Yeah.
Utterly wrong, and yet they hold them with firm belief. And as a result, are playing beautifully into the hands of radical groups like IS.
Sure, yeah.
So we need to and that was at the heart of Western rationalism. It began with Socrates. People who came to Socrates always thought they knew what they were talking about. But after half an hour of Socrates' rigorous questioning, they realised they didn't know the first thing about the basics.
Yeah.
And it finishes. You finish a Socratic dialogue with everybody, in Socrates himself, saying, "We don't know anything." And at that moment, Socrates says, "You become a philosopher." On the last day of his life, he said he was wise in only one respect, that he knew nothing at all. And this is what we need today, with all this omniscience, this cast iron certainties, hard views on people, on whole races, whole peoples, which is just tearing our world apart.
Sure. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much for talking to me today,
Karen.
It's been a pleasure. Yeah.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.